Here's the supernova. This picture is from Hubble, and I think it's around 2010 or 2011, but it shows the bright hot spots, the central object, and a few stars. Here's what I'm going to talk about. I'm going to summarize the light curves of all the different components of the object. Then I'm going to talk a little bit about the reverse shock, the hot spots, and new ALMA results. This figure is from a review article that Klaus Franz and I have just completed that will be coming out in the annual reviews of astronomy and astrophysics. The publishers won't let us distribute the article yet, but within a month it'll be available. So what you see here are three solid curves. That's the radiation, that's from the debris, the internal part of the supernova, and three dash curves that are from the ring. Let me go through them one by one. The green curve, the green curve up here is the deposition of radioactive energy into the debris. It's at the beginning, it's nickel 56, then cobalt 56, then cobalt 57, and now titanium 44. This curve is calibrated out of the titanium 44 by the new star observations of gamma rays. From the new star observations, we know how many positrons are being emitted in the interior, and it's not the gamma rays, it's the positrons that are heating the gas. And almost all of that radiation, well, the positrons heat the gas, the gas responds by making UV and optical emission, and the dust in the interior absorbs all that and re-radiates it at the far infrared. So this purple curve, just short, right underneath the green curve, is the far infrared that was measured first by the Kuiper Airborne Observatory, coming up fast, and now by Herschel and by ALMA. The fact that these two curves are so close means that there's not much room to hide a compact object. This is in orders of magnitude of solar luminosity. You can see that the debris is now about 10 to the 3 solar luminosities. But the difference between the far infrared and the gamma ray and the radioactive deposition is at most a few tens of solar luminosities. So the central object can't be brighter than a few tens of solar luminosities. The cyan is optical, and it's decreased by 7 orders of magnitude. And it never was most of the luminosity. Even in the beginning, the infrared, the near infrared, exceeded the optical. But it decayed, it tracked the 113-day decay time of cobalt 56, and then leveled off and got onto the titanium 4 curve, but now it's getting brighter. That cannot be due to radioactivity. That's due to the X-rays from the impact of the outside. The red is optical and UV emission from the shocked ring. At the beginning, there was a UV flash that made the ring become quite bright, brighter than it is now. But then that flash lasted only a day, and then the ring began to fade, and it faded more and more slowly. And now when the hotspots appeared around 5,000 days, the ring got brighter in optical and much brighter in, here's the green, is the X-rays. Dave Burrows was to tell you more about that. But you can see now that the X-ray luminosity exceeds the and the ring luminosity exceeds the luminosity of the central debris by something like an order of magnitude. And even more, this gold is near infrared, which is also coming from the ring, and its dust grains being collisionally heated by the hot X-ray emitting plasma, as Ellie Dweck has explained. So clearly it's now a remnant, because the luminosity is coming from the impact. Even the luminosity of the central object is in the optical is coming from, as Josephine Larson explained this morning, these X-rays are shining in to the debris and illuminating the ring, and that's why the debris is getting brighter. So this is summarized what I've said. And I'll just go and move on. Here's a hydro simulation we made years ago, influenced by a wonderful paper by Vikram Drakatis and Roger Chevalier that explained that there must be some intermediate density gas between the supernova, which is here at the center. The grayscale indicates density. So this is the outer envelope of the supernova. This is the unshocked material, low density gas, the density of about 1 per centimeter cube. But there's a photoionized off of the ring here, there is a torus of intermediate density gas. And when the blast wave reached out and encountered that torus, it slowed down. We saw that sudden slowing down of the motion of the blast wave, and that's when the X-rays began to turn on. But the X-rays really turned on. Oh, here's the reverse shock here. Here's the blast wave. But the reverse shock gets distorted, because when the blast wave hits this torus, it sends a reflected shock back, which merges with the reverse shock and holds the reverse shock off. But eventually the reverse shock and the blast wave encounter the dense ring. This is a section that the cylinder axis is this way. And a new reflection comes and holds off the reverse shock here. So this is the region where we're getting the strongest X-rays, is from this crash, from this material in here. We're also getting X-rays from here. This is just a cartoon of what we think the hydrodynamics is like. By the way, when a blast wave strikes an obstacle and sends a reflected shock back, if this obstacle is dense enough, that reflected shock will bounce back at twice the speed that the blast wave came up to hit it. It moves back really fast and gives an additional compression by a factor of 2.4, an additional heating by a factor of 2.5. So the reflected shock is a complex hydrodynamics. You have to think of blast wave, reverse shock, transmitted shock, reflected shock. And this is the simplest, this is as simple as it can be. Now, the nice thing about the supernova is it's a perfect Hubble's law. If you look at a line profile, then if the observer is over to the right, the redshifted part of the line corresponds exactly to a planar section of the material on the far side, and the blue shifted part of the line is emission from stuff on the near side, and you map it almost exactly into a plane. The plane is flat within one part in 1,000, and it's thin within one part in 1,000. This is a much better Hubble's law than the universe, which, because there's no great attractors, there's no dark energy screwing up the flow. The about the emission from the reverse shock. The reverse shock is a bomber-dominated shock. Anybody who studies supernova remnants appreciates the idea of a bomber-dominated shock. In the bomber-dominated shock in a supernova remnant, the shock is entering neutral hydrogen material. The blast wave from the supernova is entering neutral hydrogen in the circumstellar or interstellar gas. And as a result, the atoms in the shocked gas get excited and emit Lyman alpha and H alpha and Balmer lines. This is a little bit different, and the Balmer line emission from the blast wave entering the neutral hydrogen is narrow. It's got a width of a few tens of kilometers per second, 10 or 20 kilometers a second, because the width of that line is determined by the thermal velocity of the hydrogen atoms in the circumstellar material. But here we have a completely different frame of reference. We've got a Balmer-dominated shock, but the neutral material is the free expanding supernova debris. And so that's moving thousands of kilometers a second. So here's what happens, just as a quick summary. You have neutral hydrogen atoms entering in free expansion into the X-ray emitting plasma, which has hot protons and hot electrons. And this hydrogen atom can hit a proton and get excited, go from to H star. And that's a proton impact excitation. This could also be an electron to do the same thing. And then when you have an excited hydrogen atom, it spits out a photon that could be a Balmer line or a Lyman alpha. This photon has the same Doppler shift as the original hydrogen because these collisional excitations don't deflect the excited atom very much. They're long-range collisions, and they don't really change the velocity of the hydrogen atom very much. So when the excited hydrogen atom spits out a photon, it has the Doppler shift of the original hydrogen atom. This process of spitting out photons, well, once the excited atom turns back into a ground state atom, it can have another collision and emit another Balmer line and another, but this process is terminated when you have, instead of an excitation, an impact ionization. So then you cease to have any hydrogen atoms. You only have protons. They can make some recombination radiation, but it's negligible compared to the radiation that comes with the impact. This is close to what Josephine talked about this morning. In fact, it's the same data, some of the same data. Here's the slit of a stis placed on the ring like this. And we have to, and here's what is seen in the stis spectrometer. This emission, this is wavelength here, and to the left is to the blue, and to the right is to the red. This is stationary material that is geocoronal H alpha and nitrogen 2 material in the stationary ring. This material does not participate in the Hubble expansion, so we mask it out. But then we make a transformation because this Doppler shift is just depth into the supernova debris. And you can see this streak here. This is the reverse shock. But we like to change that from here's the depth, which is proportional to the Doppler velocity, and here's the height. So this depth here is this distance here, and the height is this distance up and down in the slit. We mask out the slit. You can clearly see the reverse shock. In fact, this is three different epochs. The red is 2006. The green is 2010, and the blue is 2014. So we have three different epochs, and you can actually see the reverse shock move into the ring. The ring, the position of the ring is here, and you can see that the reverse shock has already entered the circumstellar ring. Also, you see here what Josephine was talking about, which is the debris, which is prominent in the blue, and it's very close to the ring plane. You don't see the counterpart of the debris on the far side because it's blocked out by the dust. The dust is obscuring a good deal of the far side of the supernova debris. In fact, the reverse shock on the far side, which we do see, is much weaker than the reverse shock on the near side, and I think that's dust extinction as well. Notice also that this emission from the debris is blue, whereas here we saw red at 2006, green at 2010, and blue at 2014. This is dominated by the 2014. That's because the X-rays from this impact here are shining in here, and we didn't see much of this earlier on. It's much brighter now than it was before. We can see from the proper motion that this reverse shock is moving with a velocity 1,400 kilometers a second into the ring. So from STIS, I summarize what I've said there. Now I'm going to talk about the hotspots. Here is a montage going way back to the beginning. And the hotspots you see turned on at somewhere around day 5,000 when spot one appeared, then spots two, three, four. And at first it got much brighter on the left, which is the east side. It was brighter than the west, but now it's brighter on the east and fainter on the west. You also see the debris evolving as Josephine described. Here's an image from Katya's poster showing the new hotspots. A couple of new hotspots here and a few hotspots here. So new hotspots are forming beyond the equatorial ring. Here's the X-ray image from Chandra, which shows that the west side, that is the right-hand side, is brighter, much brighter than the left-hand side. And that's true of the optical as well, because there's more hot spots on the optical. Now, this is who do I owe this to? Klaus, is this your work?
Yeah,
probably. This is the brightness of the ring and as a function of time in the R band and the blue band. So you can see the as the hotspots turn, this is the flux from the ring. But here are some narrow lines. The oxygen 3 line started to fade. And narrow lines from the rings are fading faster than well, they're fading fast. And I can explain why, and I'm going to explain why in a moment. This is the X-rays. This is from Carrie Frank and Dave Burrows, I believe, showing that the X-rays have been growing fast, but now they seem to be leveling off. I'm not sure that they're going to stay leveling off. It depends on how much material is out beyond the equatorial ring that we see. There may be a lot more material out there. Then there's some new hot spots, and they could turn into bright X-ray sources. This is an important diagram. These show the radial distance from the center of the supernova of various hotspots. Here's the hotspots listed from 1 to 28 on the right. And basically the hotspots are circling around in a counterclockwise direction, but you can see that the hotspots have moved in by 0.05 arc, a 20th of an arc second. 10 minutes to go. Okay, I better move a little faster. So before there was hotspots, you saw the equatorial ring that was flash ionized. Once it's dominated by hotspots, the ring has moved in because the hotspots are on the inside of the ring. This has an interesting consequence. The distance to the supernova was determined by Panagia by a very simple geometric argument. He said that if you know the line of sight diameter, and that comes from the rise and fall of UV lines when the initial flash ionized the ring, that tells you that the depth of the ring from near to far. And this is the angular diameter of the ring from the Hubble image. But by the time that the Hubble got its image, this was before the hotspots arrived, you were looking at the low density ring. Now, the IUE light curves were dominated by the ring of hotspots. Because when the supernova originally flash ionized those rings, the hotspots would be brighter than the low density material. But then as time went on, the hotspots faded first, and by the time Hubble got onto the ring, you weren't seeing the dense blobs, you were seeing the low density material. The low density material is further out than the hotspots. The hotspots are on the inner side of the ring. So when they did this comparison, they weren't looking at the same ring. When they looked at the diameter, that's the low density ring. Sorry, that's the hotspots. And the angle they used here was the angle of the low density ring taken from Hubble. But they should have used a smaller diameter, which is angular diameter, one that comes from the hotspots. So if you use the hotspot angular diameter, you would increase the distance of supernova by about 5%. Now this is a picture of the Helix Nebula, and from Hubble, and you can see the Helix Nebula, it's a planetary nebula, has these tadpoles. This is this section in here, and you have a powerful wind from this central object, which is pushing the gas away and creating a cavity in the center. But the denser hotspots, I'm prejudging, the denser blobs here can't be blown away as far as well as the low density material. So the action of the pre-supernova wind would leave these little radial streamers in, and when the blast wave came across this material, it would light up the hotspots. These would become hotspots. Now, we talk about radiative shocks. In this picture here, the shock front is the left axis. Gas is coming across the shock this way, and it's shocked up to, the electrons and ions have different temperature, but if the gas downstream from the shock, the gas cools, and it collapses if there's enough time. And when that collapse occurs, the density increases, the temperature decreases by 2-3 orders of magnitude, and the density increases by 2-3 orders of magnitude, and you have a dense sheet downstream from the shock. This cooling gas here is emitting X-rays, which shine into that sheet, and the X-rays get converted to optical radiation. That's what you see as the hot spots. Meanwhile, the X-rays that the X-rays that shine into the shock, they go through. So half the X-rays get converted to optical, and so if you have a thermal collapse like this, you get optical radiation. But this cooling time, the length of this distance here, is very sensitive to the shock velocity. It goes as 3.8 power. And so high velocity shocks may never form, or may take too long to form this cooling zone. So a high velocity shock won't make an optical hotspot. It'll make an X-ray source, but it won't make an optical hotspot. But a somewhat lower velocity, you'll get optical. Well, the velocity of the shock is going to depend on the density of the hotspot. If you have a high enough density shock, it'll have a cooling layer and it'll emit optical. If you have a lower density blob, it won't emit optical. It'll emit X-rays. And furthermore, that lower density blob was emitting narrow lines. Those narrow optical lines will get erased by the passage of the shock, which raises the gas to X-ray temperature. So that's what it explains when the hotspot appeared. The narrow optical lines disappeared. So this radiative cooling creates a density threshold. Above that density threshold, you'll see optical light. Below that density threshold, you'll see only X-rays and no hotspot. I said this. Now I have minus one minute to talk about ALMA. Here's ALMA. And this is what Mikako showed. Very bright lines from rotational transitions of carbon monoxide molecules and silicon monoxide molecules. This is very important because, as I argued, there's so much dust in the interior of the supernova debris that there's no chance that we're going to get a good look at the far side of the supernova debris in optical and near-infrared radiation. We'll see some radiation from that side, but so much of it is obscured, and the morphology is so well determined, so heavily influenced by the dust, that the far side you can't see. But with submillimeter and millimeter lines, you can see right through that dust, and you can see the emission from molecules in the interior. I don't think I have time to do this. I'll just say a few last words. By looking at these line strengths, we can determine the temperature and density of the gas that's emitting the lines. We can determine the total mass of carbon monoxide and silicon monoxide. The carbon monoxide is more than 1%, more than 0.01 solar masses. That's a lower limit. You can get an upper limit to the mass. It's probably about 10 times as much. You can also determine the temperature of the gas. But the carbon monoxide, you can also, because silicon monoxide has a much bigger dipole moment than the carbon monoxide, if the carbon monoxide is 10 to the minus 2 solar masses, the silicon monoxide is 10 to the minus 5 solar masses, much less silicon monoxide. Stay tuned. We have data that is not reduced yet. We'll be able to, within a few months, we'll have 3D pictures of the carbon monoxide and silicon monoxide in the interior debris, and we'll be able to see whether the morphology is similar to what von Wathrott is simulating and the Yonker group is simulating. We'll get, for the first time, an observational test of these marvelous simulations. Thanks very much.
All right, we have time for questions. Rob?
Have you seen changes in the speed of the blast wave or the reverse shock over the last 30 years?
Have I seen changes in the...
Yeah, have they slowed down, or in the case of reverse shock, decreased, increased?
We've seen them. The reverse shock has gotten brighter, as would be expected.
Sure.
And we also see that the reverse shock is moving. We can trace its motion.
Can you estimate changes in the speed of either blast or...
Changes in what?
In the speed, in the velocity.
I don't think so. I think we don't have enough data to see acceleration of the reverse shock or deceleration. I think we can see motion of the shock, but the next derivative, I don't think our data is good enough.
Vikram.
So it seems clear from all the images and what we've seen in the last couple of years that the shock has gone out of the ring. Now it seems to be exiting the ring, or at least there's emission outside the ring. Can you comment on what we know about the material outside? Do we know, have any idea of the density? Because that might constrain essentially how we form the ring and all in the end.
Well, it's a little surprising to me that the reverse shock managed to get into the ring. I would have expected reflected shocks off the hotspots to hold the reverse shock back. So the blast wave is beyond the ring. And that raises an interesting question. Are those new hot spots, are they brightening because they're overtaken by the blast wave, or are they brightening because they're being illuminated by the X-rays? In principle, you could tell the difference, because if they're illuminated by the X-rays, the lines will be rather narrow. But if they're brightening because of the overtaking of the shock, the lines will be broad. But whether we're going to be able to get a good spectrum of those faint little spots, we might have to wait until they're a little bit brighter. I don't think I answered your question.
Okay, well, just a comment also on the thing you said about the reverse shock, you know, entering the ring and going back. So in like multi-D simulations, we sort of see you have the fingers, you get the reverse shock reflected from the fingers, but the one in between that's hitting the ring hasn't gone back as much, so it's probably close to the ring, right? At least that's what I see in some of the simulations. I haven't published them.
Well, the hotspots can be a lot smaller physically than they appear. The size of the hotspots is equal to the resolution of the Hubble telescope. The hotspots themselves can be actually smaller than they seem in the pictures. So the blast wave can go past the hotspots and be on the outside, and the blast wave has to be ahead of the reverse shock in it.
Yeah. No, the blast wave has gone through, and even the reverse shock hit the ring in some places and gone back a little bit, and in the places with the hotspots, it's gone back much further, which is sort of the reflected shock that we see, I'm saying. So we see both, I mean, at least in the simulations, I don't know how much is visible in the observation.
Yeah, I don't know.
Okay. Question, Rena.
So So if I'm talking about the Balmer emission, if I understood it correctly, it's in a sense something similar, but in a reverse verse, like what is happening in the Balmer supernova remnant. So you have the neutrons which are going fastly and hitting against the reverse shock. Now, my point is there any chance to have seen also the broad line emission component like in the supernova remnants? I think this is very unlikely on the head of the impact because you have too large velocity, but on the two sides of the impact.
I think you're talking about in a bomber-dominated shock on a remnant, you see a two component, a broad component and a narrow component. The narrow component has a velocity dispersion, which is the upstream neutral gas.
Yes.
The broad component is due to charge transfer reactions.
Yes.
Where the upstream atoms pick up the where the ions pick up electrons from the upstream atoms and have a broader line from that. That's true for shocks like in Stevens Loop or Tycho, where you have shocks of order hundreds of kilometers a second. But for 87A, this reverse shock is going at something like 8,000 kilometers a second. And at the very high velocities, the charge transfer reactions are very low, and so that other component is not there.
Yes, no, I understand, but I was meaning to on the two sides of the interaction, not on the central side of the interaction with the reverse shock, because the reverse shock would have more or less the shape of the ring, right? I don't know. Okay.
Maybe we better talk about this afterwards.